Welcome to Nostalgia Pilots, a Gundam fan cast that's just stupid trash talk. I'm Hugh.
I'm Jared.
I'm Jason.
And I'm Spence.
And today we're going to be looking at Gundam the 8th MS Team Episode 4, The Demon Overhead.
See, since this was a military piece and sort of realistic, I kind of felt like there should be a comma in there, like The Demon Overhead. And it's just all about budget overruns and storage issues.
Just like all the costs that are associated with pulling all of the Gundams out of their whatever quagmires they get in every episode because they're in the Southeast Asian jungle.
Exactly. Although I will say that that jungle, like, oh goodness, as ridiculous as this show gets sometimes, boy, do giant robots look great in the jungle.
We got a lot of great animation this episode, and
We also got a lot of Tsundere Chief going on in this episode.
Okay, I have a lot to say about this episode, because this episode nosedives right into a whole bunch of, like, uncomfortable tropes.
Yeah, this episode manages, there's some great aspects of this episode, and this episode really manages to disappoint in certain areas. And one of the things I really wanted to point, before we get to the really rough stuff, one of the initial disappointments was the episode opens on a test run of the ship, which has a ridiculous name, which I'm stalling for time as I look it up, Apsalus, the Apsalus, which I don't even know. Okay, fine. And the thing is, most of the vehicle designs in this show, a show that prides itself on its kits and its sort of extended universe viability, for a show like that, the ship design for the Apsalus sucks. It just looks like a giant sky turtle.
Dude, it's a Zaku turtle. Like,
you don't understand. Because this is Aina's ship, it's modeled after a shoulder pad.
So is this like a reject Voltron? Like, we formed together to make Voltron, but it's just the shoulder pad?
It's a Zaku with so much shoulder pad that it has dwarfed the rest of its body, and you can just see the eye peering out between two.
Well, there's a tiny head on top, and then, like, two whole body-length shoulder pads. And then whatever orb thing underneath.
I'm just saying that the model kit for this must have just stayed on shelves forever.
Oh, my God! It's Jared, you would know this. The giant space turtle kaiju that, like, spins around and has flames coming out of the holes.
Gamera, friend of all children.
Yes, this is the Zaku Gamera.
It just seemed like a really disappointing opportunity because the whole show is that, tech porn, and it just, ugh.
Looking at some of the designs of it, because we don't get a bunch of great looks. It's always like in shadow or flying through clouds or having like big rings of exhaust coming off of it this episode. But it kind of strikes me like the Zaong, like the one from the end of the original series that's just sort of like an upper torso. And then they sort of built in the rest of it later. Where it's like, we'll build a really strong torso, put a regular sized Zaku head on it, and then figure out arms and legs later.
I also have questions about the consistency of what this guy is building, because this doesn't look anything like the experimental mobile suit she had in episode one. Like, I feel like something happened, and they're like, scratch that. Let's make a giant tank. And this is what they came up with, because it was just a regular mobile suit in space. Like, it was just a fancy Zaku.
Yeah, this does like not look anything like the original thing she was fighting in piloting in episode one. Or was that just like a suit that she had in episode one?
I don't know, but they were so worried about getting the test data back, right? They kept talking about the test data. I don't know. I think we haven't totally unfurled this yet, but really this acts as the MacGuffin for the episode moving forward, right? Because they've got this test ship out, and it's essentially crashing in slow-mo. Which is the main thrust of the episode. But in the meantime, we've got Chief What's-His-Face getting in fights.
Sanders.
And he's never going to make Colonel at this rate.
Yeah.
Also, what kind of military fight takes bets, but then lets it turn into 3-on-1? Like, somebody's losing money because this is some unfair odds here.
Yeah, I had a note about that. Like, there's no way anybody who bet on the other guy is going to let that go down.
See, yeah, I think this is one of those times where Japan, like, we like military stuff, but we don't really have a military, so we're not sure how that works. So, like, they don't really understand what a soldier's mindset would be. And it was like, no, give me back the money.
Yeah.
That guy would not have been able to keep that money.
I will note that it is the old dude from his own unit that starts taking the bets.
Yeah.
Also, I'm not a gambler, so I've never understood this trope in movies and TV or whatever. When one dude is like, all right, I'm taking bets in this hat. Like, how are you keeping track of who's winning? Like, how do you keep track of how you split this money? Like, I could throw money in there and say just a random name. Like, I bet on Snuffleupagus. And then I come up and be like, well, I won. Like, no one's taking notes. There's no receipts.
Yeah, it's an absolute trope.
There's no book.
I think the way that his brain works, it just computes everything so fast that's why he has to be day drinking. Otherwise, nobody can keep up with him.
Oh, he's like Sherlock Holmes.
Exactly.
Sherlock Holmes trapped in an old prospector's body.
Exactly. Who's Watson in that scenario then?
Oh.
Okay. Michael is innately Watson, I think, all through this episode.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Like, the kid is extremely Watson.
Little narc. Child, yeah. Yes. So he actually runs off because there's a no fighting in the war room moment and tries to collect the commander, who immediately comes in and engages in fisticuffs.
Yeah, he's like, 3-on-1, not on my watch.
Yeah. Also, they're riding a bike between units?
I think that was a pretty Vietnam kind of thing. I think there's some precedent.
You know, and also, I just want to say right now, as a soldier who has had to give briefings to lower ranking soldiers. If I have to come pick up somebody from jail for fighting, I better pick up all of y'all from fighting. You don't run off and come tell me to come help fight, you coward. What kind of cohesion is this? Bruh, he instantly is like, oh, they're fighting. Help, help. Like, no, man. If he's gonna get it.
Okay, but he's also kind of playing to his strengths, which is be the communicator, because let's be real. If he tried to get in one hit, he would have been knocked to the ground and his neck would be broken. Well, and then he'd be useless.
Yeah, I think it's actually kind of foreshadowing of what happens later in the episode when they do get in a combat engagement, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. His pride is very injured because of this, because he's like, I didn't know what to do, so I ran for help.
Yo, it's like, I was sitting there watching, like, bro, you could have bit him through some dirt, a rock, maybe? Like, because at first, you know what I'm saying, Sanders was doing okay. Like, Sanders was boxing up that one guy. Like, Sanders was handling business when it was one-on-one. But then while you run off to go get help, these other two guys hem your boy up. Like, help that man out. Something. Anything. Like,
BB would not approve.
Yeah, this is not going in the letter.
Dear BB, today I was a hero. I saved Colonel Sanders. No, wait. Commander. No, wait. Chief Sanders.
Now, has old man Tom Selleck been in the show before? Is this his first appearance?
I think he was the guy who was, like, drinking lemonade in front of a fan when they first showed up.
Oh, yeah.
I like it when it's hot or whatever.
Right.
Yeah.
So he shows up, and essentially they throw out the old trope of, oh, it was friendly competition, which I think I've seen in a million college films and various other locations.
And I'm pretty sure that old man with the hat took that money and ran.
He did. That's exactly what he did, yeah.
Of course he did. That's good booze money right there.
So then we establish that Apsalis is a stupid name. Now, how uncomfortable was the Sig Zeon scene?
Oh, yeah. Super.
Okay, let me talk as a female-bodied person in this conversation. Oof. Oh, God. I wanted to punch him the minute he approached. I would have handled that much more differently, but I am not a diplomat. He would have been decked on the floor, and his balls would have been crushed under my heel. Okay, I'm done.
That comes later. That comes later.
I know.
But no, like, that whole scene from start to finish is so cringeworthy. Like, we've got Sig Zeon, then we've got instant sexual harassment, but sprinkled in there is that incest I sense?
Do I smell
some sister brother fucking?
Because they go immediately from Nazi rally to Palace of Versailles ball with like Ina in like the ruffliest dress.
Full princess mode.
I don't understand why she's not in her dress uniform.
With the most cleavage showing, like, and wait for it, she's the only woman in the room. Like, I don't see any other women.
Wolverine guy's attaché, one of them is a woman. Like, those two people who are behind him.
Mm-hmm. Like, she abandons immediately to start asking, who I assume is either a superior officer or at least the assistant or co-lead with a superior officer. And he's just like, come on, baby, be my girlfriend. Wait a minute. And then you go look at the obviously superior officer and be like, you know, she's grown up real good. Like, come on, dog.
So what do we make of the fact that he was supposed to be European? Like, was this a European caricature? His name was Kalani, which just, like, was he supposed to be Irish?
Well, he's fighting in Europe.
Right.
Yeah, came from the European front.
They're all from Zeon, Zeon, so.
Yeah, yeah, fair. I just wasn't sure.
So they're, like, from space, but they're also aristocrats, and it's not really clear.
Yeah.
But I will say that I'm impressed that they, like, went and, like, they built a, like, palace balcony on the edge of this mountain fortress that they're in for her to go out and stand on and look at the sky.
Contemplation balcony. You will leave me with my one and only guard.
She did her best Relina impression. Like, mm-hmm. I was waiting for her to scream for Hero to murder her.
Yeah, well, I realized how far we'd come from Relina when I saw her come in full princess mode, because I like her in, like, you know, action suit Jerrica mode, where she's got maybe a little bit too much shoulder pad, but she's still kicking ass and getting things done. Like, this felt awful.
Also, I mean, not to give Relina too much credit, but when Relina got in her military best, she had epaulets and tassels mm-hmm. and all kinds of awesome things.
Mm-hmm.
Not the Power Girl cleavage window dress, where you're literally the only woman in a dress. Like, I just... Oh, God, Japan, stop it. Like... And also to be fair about this trope of a character, in latter forms of anime or in any other contemporary anime, he probably wouldn't have just been considered to be European. They would have said he was American. Like, this brash, like, cowboy-esque hot shit cockwalk of the, you know, character would have been solidly American. Probably super blonde. His name probably would have been Chibbity Crockett. So to give him a European bent, I think is their attempt at kind of easing the Nazi analogy a bit. You're like, oh, he's European, you know, like, nah, dog, we get it. We know exactly what this character's here for.
Mm-hmm. And you do know that the Nazis were also European, right?
Yeah, well, yeah.
Yeah, like, you can't smooth it over by being like, yeah, see, that vaguely white, brownishly tan European over there was a rude douchebag too, right? See? Mm-hmm. It's even. So,
did you guys watch this in sub or dub?
I watched it in sub.
I watched the dub.
Okay, so I went with dub, but I had the subtitles on at the same time just to compare. And when they're out on that balcony, there's a long speech between Jerrica and a dude named Norris. And they're talking about how his destiny is linked with her family's, and they're both relatively, well, I mean, they're supposed to be relatively inspiring sort of forward-looking speeches. But in the dub, he says, "My name will be linked forever with yours." But in the sub, she immediately responds with, "Thank you, Norris." And there was something hilarious to me about that, because his name was just Norris, that I could not, thank you, Norris. Thank you, Tony.
No, like, Norris is his last name. Like, she is her butler. It is weird.
Yeah, the whole... Anyway, and then, of course, now that we finally have a name for him, when they do get up in the air together, because I guess he's a butler plus a pilot, he immediately dies.
He gets shot. Like, he gets damaged, but he lives.
Oh, that's right. She manages to whisk him away.
She uses her Lapida beam or whatever it is that's on the bottom of this thing to like fight, like just devastate the jungle.
Yeah, but we're getting away from the B plot, which is that
campfire time.
Yeah, yes.
Sanders. So the plebs and the Federation are off at this campfire.
This is where Karen shines.
Oh my god. Like,
she shines, but at the same time, I'm like, come on, do we have to have weird fetishes in every episode or like every few episodes? First, it was the prepubescent looking teenage girl being nakedly ogled. Now we have I'm an older aka Japanese businessman. Woe is me. Now my tsundere interest is going to curb stomp me for my enjoyment. And it spurs him on for some reason.
Well, you know, I hadn't even made that association. I'm going to be honest. Now that you say it.
That wasn't the association I made, but yeah, there's a lot of like she needs him in the balls.
No, yeah.
Hard.
Dude, she full on rugby punts this guy. Like, like, and by the way, I just want to say it is exquisitely animated too. Like, it's slow mo.
So good.
Like, and I love how no one follows orders of a superior officer. Like, the commander's like, stop this, and she's like, oh yeah, punch. He goes, literally, stop this, and she's like, fine, kick him in the balls. Like, it's like,
but I do like that at the wrap of the previous in the fight scene, we do pan up and see her like glowering down from the shoulder pad of her mobile suit like she's fucking Batman.
Yes.
Like, don't get me wrong, I get that she, you know, she has to do this, and I'm actually glad it's her that does it, because in a typical military sci-fi thing, this would be the pull you up by the bootstraps from your commanding officer rally speech. No, she gives those speeches. She beats this guy's ass. Like,
and she's like, I'm not dying because you think you're cursed.
Yeah, oh yeah. So what's happening is that Sanders is planning to put in for a transfer because he doesn't want the 8th MS team to get killed, because every other team he's been on has died. Except for him on their third mission.
Yeah.
But I mean, like, the war is like what? Like a month, 2 months old at this point? How many units could he have been in?
Doesn't this kind of take the gas out of his character for the rest of the series, though? Haven't they kind of played the card? Like, if he survives the third mission, if they all survive the third mission, then the curse is kind of over and his character background is what?
Well, I think this was sort of like the introduction to the thing, but now we're getting into the there's a giant robot. There's an even gianter robot that now everyone has to find.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. But, and
they finally and also, play it smart in this scenario. They're like, okay, let's lay low. We'll watch and see what happens. And then
while they're waiting, there's a scene where he's writing what's that guy's name? Michael or whatever is writing in his journal. And he's like, oh, you're writing a letter already? And he's like, no, I'm writing my will. And I really wish they had followed through with the second beat of the gag where halfway through the fight, for whatever reason, he had to go back and change his will.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay. The thing that bothered me about this whole thing with Sanders being like, I need to get out of here so you all don't die, is that I feel like it kind of plays into like the superstitious black person trope.
Oh,
Sanders, in a way that I feel very uncomfortable with.
Well, so there's actually a long history of military and superstitions, and so it does not surprise me that they pulled on that trope, because like other people in other units hearing about this curse, it's something that's very familiar, especially for the Navy. Because there are a lot of things that can make you go crazy, and senseless violence and senseless death is not something that somebody can accept. So placing the blame on a curse or on a specific person is a way to deal with that, because it gives the death meaning and purpose, even if that is to the detriment of the one who is quote unquote cursed.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And on top of that, though, like, they also have things about women being on the ship and being bad luck and you know, having this dynamic between the two of them, her being female, him being the older put upon dude, kind of plays that up where she's basically saying, you're not the curse. And you could almost have her say, you know, I'm not the curse either. Like, say if this was a boat of some kind. Mm-hmm. But that analogy of the superstitious black person is pretty apt, because he then becomes the magical black person, because for some reason, the female character who gets a little gung-ho and saves his ass then has to get her ass saved by him, who somehow, like, he just for somehow he can hold up toe-to-toe with this thing that's discharging EMP pulses and making tornadoes and, like, yeah. just exuding so much power that, like, both of them should have been eliminated immediately, especially with it having two escort planes. Like,
my question is, how did this thing get close enough to, like, physically body Karen's mobile suit?
She's got the best. She's got Michael Jordan boosters. She can sky high.
That scene was hilarious because she jumps and there's nothing but open sky, and then she gets run over by an airplane, essentially. Like, that whole sequence had me laughing out loud.
And this thing is massive. It is, again, it's kind of like in G Gundam, like, you guys haven't seen it, but, like, or better yet, like in Gundam Wing, the perspective on these ships goes from, like, at first it's comparable in size to those jets, like, that, you know what I'm saying, like, it looks, you know, larger, but it's still comparable. Then all of a sudden it's massive, like, it's bodying this mobile suit, which we all know is huge, right? Like, a couple stories at least, maybe three stories tall, and it bodies this thing and towers over them. Like, and I feel like when it hit her, it should have been like,
yeah.
Like, she should have gotten, like, a spiraling off into the sky, like, Team Rocket moment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. He gets the twinkle in the distance.
So I will say, though, as silly as that little moment is, the rest of this fight looks pretty fantastic. Like, the animation in the sequence is really good. The plane, the Asparagus, no, sorry, the Apsilis, which up until this point hasn't really done much. The whole sort of, I was trying to grasp what the equivalent might be in the Vietnam era of this sort of super weapon, like just this wide range, almost nuclear devastation, but I couldn't really come up with a good cross-reference. They're not really doing, like, an Agent Orange reference here.
I mean,
I think it's just because of the Gundam. You have to have a giant supersuit.
Yeah, fair.
Yeah, I mean, you can make an analogy to, like, when tanks kind of first came on the battlefield, you know, something like that. Because you know, if you consider the mobile suits to be ground troops, then this thing is some big up-armored weapon of some kind, you know? So they had to obviously change their tack, like, you know, even the commander says, no, just keep shooting until your guns overheat. Like, he realized that, you know, without saying it, that this thing is slow. It doesn't seem to be able to fire any weapons, you know, super quickly. So if we just overpower this thing with covering fire, we're either going to scare it off or down it somehow. Even though I don't know how this thing flies, because it only seems to have one way to propel itself, and that's with its belly booster. So it's a hovercraft turtle, potentially.
Yeah, it's very unclear. The aerodynamics are very poor.
But hey, it's a flying saucer robot Zaku turtle. It's fine. We'll watch it. It's fine.
All I can compare it to, because I just started playing Destiny 2, is those big eyeball thingies that shoot purple at you. I don't know what they are.
The screechers. Yeah. From the hive.
Okay. Yeah.
So was it just me, or did this sequence essentially end because, oops, all of a sudden the ship worked and it was just like, oh, it's working again. Okay, I'm out.
Yeah.
Well, and I think it was Norris who was like, hey, you're being riddled with holes. Don't do that. Let's go.
Well, the reason that she was going low was because one of her engines failed, right?
Yeah, but then all of a sudden it worked again.
Maybe it has, like, nanites that are fixing it, like your your blood clots so that you can stop bleeding.
Does this have the same operating system as the Tall Geese? Does she just need to concentrate really hard for it to work?
Well, it kind of implies that earlier in the episode, right? Because her brother's like, they're telling the brother, Kalani says to the brother, you should probably call her back or whatever, and he's like, no, I think she'll figure it out. Like, I don't think that's how electronics and mechanical systems work. I don't think you can just try harder.
I also don't think that's how you treat your sister, who's obviously risking her life to test pilot this robot that you obviously don't have the fortitude.
And the weird thing is, he's right in the end.
So I actually think that it actually shows a great deal of trust between the two of them, where he is trusting her abilities as a pilot and not trying to be overprotective brother, but really respecting her agency and her skill as a pilot.
That's fair. And to be fair, in the end, he is correct because she just tries harder and drives away. So
the other thing that I think happened is, like, Norris said he was, like, releasing extra Minovsky particles. And basically, Minovsky particles are Gundam duct tape. So, like, if something's broken on a mobile suit, just broadcast extra Minovsky particles and it's fine.
So it's the wrench of the series, you're saying?
Yes. Well, of the whole Universal Century, really.
Yeah.
It's psychic teenagers from space.
Yeah, because I think the Minovsky particles, like, if you ever see a Gundam that glows and sparkles and does things like the Unicorn Gundam or anything like that, those are because of Minovsky particles. Like,
there's a Unicorn Gundam?
Yeah. Oh God. Yeah, it's definitely in the Universal Century because one of the differences between the Universal Century and the other Gundam stuff is that the main Gundam always transforms somehow. Like, in the original Mobile Suit Gundam, it had different things that it could connect to and get guns and things. And the Unicorn Gundam has different sets of armor. Like, it has, like, just all these different things. Like, there's, I think, the Burst Unicorn Gundam where it gets a bunch of spiky things and a big gun and all this kind of stuff. So, like, yeah, the unicorn, and it does have a actual unicorn horn. So, you know, it's pretty fabulous.
That's awesome.
So this episode ends with another weird moment where they just have an almost like the ship flies away and then the commander's like, we can do anything if we try hard enough. And then they may as well have freeze framed on them all high fiving in the air.
Like, but like we get like godlight coming down through the cloud cover. And even though the like Forrest is so devastated by this attack. Like, they're also like, we're so great.
We beat the thing and stuff.
Like, did you see how much damage that thing did?
Which, yeah, it's like, our enemy has a new super weapon and we barely survived. High five!
and what was that EMP pulse it nearly melted our mobile suits with? Can you tell me what that is? Also, are those rebels still alive? Because I'm pretty sure they live in the jungle that was just decimated.
And the biggest problem is that you couldn't get any readings because the EMPs would have taken out your pillbox.
Yeah, and all those Minovsky particles kept communications down too. Like they even have a line where they're like, I think I heard through all these Minovsky particles something or other, and I'm like, wait, so you can actually physically see or hear through them, like they're a physical thing? Like, all right, okay. I feel like they're going to be also next. They're going to be like, all right, you've got to absorb those Getter rays so you can power your new robot. Now scream with youthful passion.
Roar!
Yeah, it's just, it's, oh gosh. But hey, the return of machismo piloting.
Yes. Okay, do we have anything else we want to talk about this episode, or should we move into our favorite parts?
Favorite parts.
Yeah, favorite parts. I gotta say my favorite part is definitely, I'm gonna say, her getting ran over by a giant space turtle. Like, it just, oh God. And the whole time she's like, I'm not gonna die. Bat. Like, it just, it was good timing.
Yeah, because she's having that moment and then it just runs. It's like the first final destination.
Yes!
Scene. Anyway, yeah, no, I was going to say that was my favorite moment as well. For some reason, I love the animation in the jungle combat, and there was some neat sort of Zaku Aizen moments, but no, that was definitely the moment for me.
You need to make a gif of that. You need to make a gif of that. But yes. Then as soon as she gets hit, it cuts to those guys doing the, oh!
My favorite part has to be the uncomfortable ball, because this just becomes an entirely different anime for 5 minutes, complete with her having the French Revolution balcony for her to stare up at the stars and curse her lot in life as a princess, while her escort like pledges her life, his life to like protecting her. It's like, no, you're a pilot. You pilot a giant robot in this war that's going to become significantly more horrible over time. This is not anything that makes that fits here. Yeah. Why does your like hidden mountain base have a balcony at all? Who put that there? Why does it have French columns?
My brother did. He thought it would look nice.
You hear them mumbling in the background. Well, Trey's had a rose-scented bath.
My favorite part is Karen basically like being like, oh, you're feeling down on yourself because you think you're cursed. Let me make you feel better. And then punch to the face, punch to the gut, kicking balls. Yeah. That all made me very happy.
I'll be glad when we get some more of her backstory. I wonder how she became such a spitfire to where she's like, I'm just gonna beat the crap out of this guy because he needs it. Like, oh, and fuck our commander because that guy's trash.
I'm waiting for like a Bloodsport style montage of her just beating up all these dudes.
yep, with a wrench, because it has to be the wrench that she threw at Elidor in the first episode. Because
wrenches can do anything.
They can do anything.
If you believe enough.
Yes, if your wrench has enough machismo, it can do anything.
Perfect line to end the podcast.
So you can find all my business over at hugeodonnell.com.
You can find all of mine over at skinner.fm.
Find me at nerdswithvoices.com.
And find me at resonantmoon.com.
Links and show notes are up at nostalgiapilots.com, and follow us on Twitter at nostalgiapilots. So until next week.
I will not die because of a curse.
I'm still alive.
Keep your wrenches at hand. And all your Minoski particles.
If you like audiobooks and science fiction, you should be listening to Glow in the Dark Radio for free science fiction audio adventure every week, written and read by author and radio host Mike Luoma. Me. As an up-and-coming independent writer, I share my work for free each week, chapter by chapter, to get you into my science fiction, I hope. Check out all my books at glowinthedarkradio.com and listen to Glow in the Dark Radio free each week on iTunes, TuneIn, or just head to glowinthedarkradio.com.